Okay, so let's talk about something you literally see everywhere. I mean, look around you right now. Someone nearby is probably scrolling, right? Social media isn't just a thing anymore. It's woven into everything. And get this, the average user, they're spending 2 hours and 23 minutes every single day on these platforms. That's quite a chunk of time.
It really is a huge chunk.
So that brings us to the big question for today's deep dive, looking at the sources you've brought. Is all this connection actually good for us? Or have we maybe wandered into a public health issue without really noticing?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And honestly, there's no simple yes or no. Even big organizations like the American Psychological Association, they basically say it's a tool that, well, it charms and harms.
Charms and harms. I like that.
Exactly. Because the benefits, especially for finding community, they can be really significant. But the potential downsides, they're very real and increasingly well documented. We can't just ignore them.
Which is precisely why we're doing this. We've gathered, official advice, some deep research from major health groups here in the U.S. The goal today is really to unpack the facts, get past the sort of clickbait headlines, and give you a clear, balanced picture of how this stuff actually affects our mental well-being.
Let's get into it.
Okay, so to really grasp the seriousness here, I think we have to start with a big warning flare sent up in 2023. The advisory from the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, that really put a spotlight on the growing concern, especially for young people's mental health and its link to social media.
Right, and what was really striking about that advisory wasn't just, a general be careful. It actually pointed to a specific number, a kind of
A
threshold.
threshold.
Yeah. The key finding was around 3 hours. American teens, specifically between 12 and 15, if they spent more than 3 hours a day scrolling social media, they faced double the risk of poor mental health outcomes.
Wow, double the risk.
Double the risk. We're talking things like depression symptoms, anxiety symptoms. Just crossing that 3-hour line seemed to be a major tipping point, according to that research.
And what's behind that risk? I mean, we've all felt it, right? That FOMO thing, fear of missing out.
Oh, absolutely. FOMO is a huge driver. We know intellectually that these platforms are highlight reels, right? They're curated, polished, often totally unrealistic.
Yeah, nobody posts their bad hair days.
Exactly. So you're seeing these perfect snapshots of other people's lives, and it's almost impossible not to compare. It just fuels those feelings of, ugh, my life isn't that great. And researchers have directly tied that specific kind of social media FOMO to not getting enough sleep. Plus, more anxiety, more depression. It's like a little psychological pressure cooker in your pocket.
So zooming out a bit, if we look at the consensus among mental health professionals, it seems pretty clear, doesn't it? Heavy social media use, the kind that's not really managed, is linked pretty strongly to a higher risk of depression, anxiety, loneliness, even self-harm and suicidal thoughts in some cases.
Yeah, the correlation is consistent across a lot of studies. It's a serious pattern, and we really have to take it seriously. And, digging a bit deeper into the data, it's clear this doesn't hit everyone the same way. Some groups seem to be particularly vulnerable.
Right. And first, it's just the sheer scale of access is kind of mind-blowing.
Outrage.
The sources mentioned nearly half of all teenagers say they use the internet almost constantly. Constantly.
Yeah.
And even though most platforms say you need to be 13, the reality, almost 40% of kids aged 8 to 12 are already on social media. So they're getting exposed really, really young.
And that early exposure, unfortunately, often bumps up against issues of gender and harassment. The Surgeon General's advisory specifically called out some, frankly, disturbing numbers about adolescent girls. Nearly 60% said they'd felt uncomfortable because of something a stranger did or said online.
50%. That's huge. And what about the body image stuff? That seems to come up constantly.
It does, and the numbers are stark there, too. 46% of teenage girls, so ages 13 to 17, said social media made them feel worse about their bodies.
And that's just the ones who say it,
Yeah.
right? You have to imagine the real number feeling the pressure is probably even higher. It sets such an unrealistic, punishing standard.
Absolutely. And beyond just feeling bad about yourself, there's also the constant bombardment with toxic content. The data shows 64% of teens say they've seen hate-based stuff online at least sometimes.
Wow.
And it gets even worse for certain groups. 1 in 3 adolescent girls of color report seeing racist content online. So we're not just talking about comparisons, we're talking about direct exposure to hate and harassment.
That's incredibly concerning. It really makes you wonder how the design of these platforms plays into this, especially with different age groups. I saw something interesting in one of your sources, a 2022 study looking at adults.
Ah, yes, that multidisciplinary study. That was fascinating. It found that for adults under 35, using Facebook was linked to depression symptoms. But for the over 35 crowd, it wasn't Facebook. It was using platforms like TikTok or Snapchat, the more visual, maybe more algorithm-intense platforms that was connected to depression symptoms for them. Facebook use wasn't.
So the type of platform really matters depending on maybe what you grew up with or how your brain interacts with it at different stages.
Exactly. It suggests that the specific features, the visual nature, the algorithmic feed, the whole culture of the network interacts differently with users based on their age and maybe their developmental experience with these technologies. It's not one size fits all.
Okay, so let's shift gears slightly to the how. How does scrolling for hours actually, translate into these negative mental health effects? Your sources break down quite a few mechanisms, but maybe we can focus on, say, the top few that people might really feel day to day.
Yeah, good idea. One of the most immediate and obvious is sleep disruption. We hear about blue light messing with melatonin, and that's true. But honestly, it's also just the addictive nature of the scroll, right? You plan to check for 5 minutes, and suddenly it's an hour later, and you've lost precious sleep.
Guilty as charged.
We all are. And that lost sleep directly impacts anxiety levels, mood, focus, everything the next day. It's a vicious cycle.
And that ties right into technology addiction, doesn't it? Which sounds kind of extreme, but the way these things are designed.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned brain changes.
Precisely. This is where the neuroscience perspective comes in. It's all about those reward pathways in the brain. Getting a notification, a like, a new comment, it's like a tiny, unpredictable hit of dopamine. It's variable reinforcement, just like a slot machine.
So it trains your brain.
Sort of, yeah. Evidence is building that this kind of constant, frequent use might be linked to actual changes in brain areas involved with emotion, learning, impulse control. Even how sensitive we are to social rewards and punishments. It basically conditions your brain to crave that quick, easy digital validation over, say, more complex, real-world stuff.
That's powerful. Another big one you pulled out was the normalizing of high-risk behaviors. How does that work?
Well, think about viral challenges that are sometimes dangerous, or communities promoting extreme dieting, or even tragically self-harm content. The algorithms are designed to keep you engaged, and sometimes they can push users, especially vulnerable ones, down these rabbit holes where harmful or risky behaviors start to seem normal, even encouraged.
Right, the algorithmic echo chamber effect. But okay, we need to be careful here, don't we? You mentioned some nuance from researchers like at Johns Hopkins. They caution against just saying social media causes depression. Full stop.
Exactly. It's rarely that simple with mental health. Depression is complex, lots of factors involved.
So is it the cause or is it that people who are already depressed use it more? What's the deal there?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting. It seems to be more of a correlation paradox, or maybe a feedback loop. Research shows that people who are already feeling depressed do tend to spend more time on social media, maybe looking for connection or distraction, but then that increased use might also worsen their symptoms.
Ah, okay. So it goes both ways, a kind of chicken and egg situation.
Pretty much. It seems to reinforce itself. But wait, there's another layer. Some studies suggest there might be a sweet spot.
A sweet spot for social media use.
Yeah, kind of. They found higher rates of depression symptoms associated with both very low social media use and very high social media use. So being completely disconnected isn't necessarily the ideal, but obviously excessive use is clearly linked to problems.
That makes sense. Moderation is key. Again. And maybe the simplest mechanism of harm is just what you're not doing when you're scrolling, the offline trade-off.
That's a huge factor. It's basic displacement. If you're spending, say, 2 or 3 hours a day staring at a screen, that's 2 or 3 hours you're not spending being physically active or being outside in nature or having real face-to-face conversations.
All things that we know are good for mental health.
Exactly. Things that naturally boost endorphins, build real social skills, reduce stress. So a lot of the time, social media is directly pushing out the very activities that could help buffer against anxiety and depression.
Okay, wow. That is quite a list of concerns. Structural, neurological, social. It's easy to feel a bit down about the whole thing.
It can be, yeah.
But let's hit pause on the digital doom and gloom for a second, because, as you said, terms and harms. If this tool is so widespread, touching billions of lives, it must be doing some good too, right? Otherwise, why would we all be using it? We have to look at those benefits, the charms.
Absolutely. And those charms can be incredibly important, especially again for young people or those in marginalized groups. Think about someone who feels isolated or different in their immediate physical world. Maybe they're shy, maybe they're exploring their identity, maybe they have unique interests. Social media can be a lifeline.
How so? Can you give an example?
Sure. Take, for instance, an LGBTQ plus teen living in a small town where maybe they don't feel accepted or understood. Online, they can find communities of people who share their experiences, who offer validation, support, crucial information. It can provide a kind of psychological safety net that might be totally missing offline.
So it builds real support systems. I saw helpguide.org mention some specific mental health pluses too. It wasn't just finding community, but also like giving or receiving emotional support during tough times.
Yes, exactly. People use it to connect during illness, bereavement, major life changes. It also helps people find actual mental health resources or online care. And crucially, it can make it easier for people to take that first step in seeking help.
Making it easier to ask for help, that's huge.
It really is, whether that's finding a therapist, affirming your identity, or just connecting with others who understand a specific challenge, like a rare disease. It can lower the barrier to entry for getting support. And honestly, it helps reduce stigma, too, just by allowing more open conversations about mental health to happen.
That's a great point. And then there are the more sort of practical upsides, right? Mm-hmm. Staying in touch with family far away, professional networking, learning new things, getting involved in causes.
Definitely. It's a powerful tool for learning, for connecting with people who share professional interests, for mobilizing around social or political causes you care about. Education, connection, mobilization, those are real tangible benefits.
Okay, so we have the harms, we have the charms. It's complicated. What does this mean for us, the actual users scrolling away? Clearly, just banning it isn't the answer, or even possible for most people. It's about finding a healthier way to live with it, right?
Exactly. Developing a more mindful, balanced relationship. And there's one piece of research that offers a really concrete, actionable strategy. It's that 2018 University of Pennsylvania study.
Yes. Tell us about that one.
It's quite compelling because it gives a specific target. They had young adults limit their social media use to just 30 minutes per day total across all platforms.
30 minutes? Wow, that sounds challenging.
It does, but the results were significant. Those who stuck to that 30-minute limit reported significantly lower levels of anxiety, depression, loneliness, sleep problems, and even FOMO compared to the control group.
Okay, so cutting back that much makes a measurable difference, but how? 30 minutes feels tough. It suggests we need more than just willpower. We need actual strategies.
Definitely. Willpower alone usually isn't enough against these very carefully designed platforms. So the sources suggest practical steps. First, taking regular intentional breaks from your devices altogether, like putting the phone away for an hour or two.
And turning off notifications. That seems key.
Absolutely critical. Notifications are engineered to hijack your attention. Turning them off, or at least customizing them heavily, puts you back in control of when you engage.
Setting up phone-free times or zones makes sense, too. Like, maybe no phones at the dinner table, or that classic advice about the hour before bed. That blue light thing is real.
It really is. Establishing a tech-free buffer before sleep is crucial for melatonin production. And the advice for adults. Seriously consider charging your phone overnight in a different room. Make the bedroom a genuinely phone-free sanctuary. It reinforces that boundary. The tech doesn't control your rest.
We also have to talk about perception, right? That constant reminder, especially for younger users, that social media isn't real life.
Fundamentally important, drilling home the fact that posts are curated, edited, sometimes professionally produced. Comparing your messy reality to someone else's perfect-looking feed is just, well, as they say, comparison is the thief of joy, especially when it's an unfair comparison against something manufactured.
And for parents, that means modeling good behavior themselves, right?
Yeah.
Not just telling kids what to do.
Exactly. Kids watch what adults do. Parents need to demonstrate healthy tech habits and actively talk about social media citizenship. You know, the basic idea of don't post something online that you wouldn't say to someone's face. Treat people online with respect.
Good advice for everyone, really. So, looking ahead, this isn't a settled issue, is it? Research is still figuring things out.
Right. There are still big questions, like, does it matter how you use it? is passively scrolling through feeds different from actively posting and messaging? How much do the specific design choices and algorithms of each platform contribute to mental health outcomes, positively or negatively? These are areas of active research that will likely shape advice in the future.
So the understanding is still evolving.
Constantly. The complexity of the tool means we need ongoing critical thinking from researchers, from the platforms themselves, hopefully, and definitely from all of us as users.
Okay, so if we were to boil this all down, the main takeaway seems to be that social media is this incredibly potent force. It's not inherently evil, it's not purely good, it just requires awareness, mindfulness, and definitely moderation.
Precisely. The goal isn't necessarily elimination for everyone, but learning to manage it healthily. Think of it like a relationship with food or exercise too little or too much can be harmful. Finding the right balance is key. We need to be the ones controlling the tool.
Controlling the tool, not letting it control us. I like that. We heard that advice about maybe delaying smartphones for kids until they're ready, which makes sense. But tech isn't going away, right? It's part of life now, from childhood onwards.
For the foreseeable future, yes.
So that leaves us with a final thought, maybe something for you, the listener, to chew on. If this technology is going to be with us our whole lives, what's the fundamental digital literacy skill we need? Going beyond just online safety or spotting fake news, what's the deeper skill we need to teach ourselves, and especially young people, so we can truly stay in the driver's seat?
That ability to self-regulate, to recognize when design is trying to manipulate our attention or emotions, to consciously choose how and when we engage. That feels like the critical skill for navigating the future. How do we build that internal governor? That's the question worth exploring.